Well, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, Dignitas Infinita, Infinite Dignity, is the name of a new declaration by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome, what used to be the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And it is a document that looks very intently at the dignity of the human person. And in its very introduction, it says, "Every human person possesses an infinite dignity inalienably grounded in his or her very being, which prevails in and beyond every circumstance, state, or situation the person may ever encounter." But then it also enumerates very clearly the many grave threats that exist today as we try to defend that human dignity that we believe so firmly in. So what are we to make of Dignitas Infinita in this pontificate? What are we to make of it in comparison to Fiducia Supplicans, the recent decree from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, also that opens a door for blessings of same-sex couples, non-liturgical blessings of same-sex couples, and those in irregular situations? There is a great deal to understand in this document, and to help us all do that, I have the distinct pleasure of being joined by Father Thomas Petri, the president of the Dominican House of Studies. Yes, he is a Dominican, a very great Dominican. And I also have the great privilege of calling him a friend. So, Father, welcome.
Thanks, Matthew. It's great to be back here in Guadalupe Studios here in D.C., where we have many long memories from many years ago.
We do. Yeah, I still remember sitting in this studio with you, and I miss those days.
Yeah, it was great. Some great mornings up here.
Well, you are a very busy man, so I'm grateful that you could find the time to spend with me here in studio, no less.
It's great to be able to look each other in the eye and have a great conversation that our friends will be able to listen in on.
Yeah, so we've been hearing about this document for a while. Apparently, it's been in the works for, 5 years by the Dicastery, what was at the time the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. There are reports that the USCCB had a document that it was planning to release back in 2018, but they were asked not to because the Dicastery was working on something. So what should we think that it has taken 5 years for this document to come to light?
Well, I'm glad it took that long, to be honest with you. I think, in the introduction, you mentioned a contrast between this document and Fiducia Supplicans. What we know about Fiducia Supplicans is that it was written quite quickly and without a whole lot of consultation. In his presentation of this document, of Dignitas Infinita, Cardinal Fernandez lists all the various years and the different meetings and the drafts that this document has gone through, which means it has been, in fact, not only drafted, but edited and reviewed by theologians and by those at the Holy See, especially in the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, who are responsible for articulating the Church's teaching, especially in regard to these very sensitive and delicate issues.
Yeah, Pope Francis last year, in an interview with Argentinian television, I think it was, made the statement that the Church needs to continue developing her understanding of human dignity. That seems to be playing out in this document with sort of a broader vision, and not an incorrect one, but a broader vision of what would be a threat to human dignity.
I think that's right. So the document is certainly based on the foundations of Church teaching and the foundations and the developed Church teaching on human dignity, which is in fact, modern term. You know, human dignity is a 19th century terminology. St. Thomas Aquinas would not have spoken about human dignity, nor St. Augustine. They would speak about the human person being made in the image and likeness of God, right?
And Imago Dei actually does appear also in this document.
Absolutely, as a strong emphasis here. So to build on what we mean by human dignity, and then to bring in some greater distinctions in line with what we're seeing in the world, like, for example, and I know we'll get to some of this, but like the distinction between ontological dignity, moral dignity, social dignity, and existential dignity.
Yeah. So let's answer one question right off the bat. What is the weight of this document?
Well, it's I think the weight of it, it's a declaration. So it's not an encyclical. It's also not a motu proprio. And the Holy Father has been issuing a lot of motu proprios
yes.
in his pontificate. And motu proprios are, by his own initiative, and often used to change the laws of the
right.
Church.
He's used it also to alter the language of the Catechism.
Exactly. So that's right. The language of the Catechism was issued by a motu proprio. Since this is a declaration of the Dicastery, but also approved by Francis in audience for approval, it shares in the papal magisterium. Now, its weight and how you submit to it is going to be with submission of religious intellect, right? And the weight of it, as far as fallibility or infallibility, is not going to devolve from how it was issued, but in fact the content. And the content, most of the content, is in fact solid content that has been part of the ordinary and universal teaching of the Church now for generations. Now, there might be a room for prudential disagreements on certain concrete solutions or practical matters,
right,
but certainly it should be taken seriously and received with submission of intellect
and will.
Now, to
the point of content, that brings us to Fiducia, because one of the things that we heard coming out of it, because there was a firestorm of controversy surrounding it, and we had like almost every Episcopal conference in Africa, except for one, which I think was South Africa, saying this simply is not enforceable here. What's the difference in terms of weight?
Well, I think Fiducia Supplicans, that's an interesting question, because it does seem even after the firestorm, Cardinal Fernandez walked it back, because when they issued it, he said there'd be no further statements on the matter. And then I think within a week, right, he had to have an interview, and then he also had to issue a much longer explanation of
right.
how to...
Which is usually a sign there's a problem.
Yeah, that's right. So I think because it wasn't received, because reception is also a part of this, right? I think it's clear Fiducia Supplicans isn't able to be received worldwide and is in fact about a pastoral matter. I think this is one of the things that characterizes Pope Francis's pontificate. And one of the things I think that probably causes a lot of folks some consternation on both sides of the ideological spectrum, mm-hmm. Those who would wish he would be more progressive than he is and those who wish he would be more traditional than he is. I think the Holy Father obviously holds to the Church's teaching, but as a pastor, he wants to find ways that people can live the Church's teaching. Now, the way he does it might be different than the way I would want to do it or the way another pastor would want to do it, but he's bringing a pastoral sense. And I think Fiducia Supplicans was an attempt, whether or not you think it was the correct attempt or the way to do it, to figure out how to incorporate those in irregular situations into the life of the Church without compromising the teaching of the Church. And different people, of course, have different understandings of whether or not that's actually successful.
Right. This document, on the other hand, is applicable in every setting.
That's right, because this is not simply a pastoral prudential document in the way I think Fiducia Supplicans was intended to be. This is about the basic teaching. This is about, and in fact uses this terminology, this is about intrinsic truth and the intrinsic dignity and intrinsic and always evil violations of that dignity.
You and I think have read pretty much everything that has come out in this pontificate. Would it be wrong to say that this is one of the most very precisely theological documents that we've seen?
I think that's right. I think, you know, Pope Francis has always been very clear, even in his own audiences, that he doesn't think like a theologian, you know,
right.
And he trusts the theologians who are around him. And so his text and his audiences don't often have the same theological feel that we would expect, say, from Pope Benedict XVI, but they do tend to have a very pastoral feel. So this is certainly truly a much more, if I can use the word, and hopefully not in a negative way, rigorous
right.
document than what we're probably used to seeing from this pontificate.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about this later, but this is a pontificate of footnotes, as you and I have actually
yes.
talked a few times,
yeah.
both on and off the air.
Yeah.
This is a pontificate of footnotes, and the footnotes are very interesting in this one because of the citations to popes other than Francis.
Yeah.
John Paul II in particular.
In particular, and I noticed the very last line of the document notes that it was signed on April 2nd, which is the anniversary of, and notes that this is the anniversary of John Paul II's death.
Yeah, and it quotes from Evangelium Vitae.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the two words of the title, infinite dignity, dignitas infinita. Is this the right, because I'm seeing, for example, some the would-be theologians on X and elsewhere saying, well, you can't say infinite because dignity can't be infinite. We're finite creatures.
Right. So that there is some pushback on that language, on infinite dignity. I think there is a way to understand that word, and I think St. Thomas would agree with us. You know, we can speak of St. Thomas would say you can speak of infinite in many ways, right? And certainly, yes, God is infinite. Only he is infinite, which is in the Latin simply means without limit. And only his dignity is infinite. I think when this usage of the word infinite in regard to our dignity, really what should be understood as another word that we've seen in the church's documents, inestimable, mm-hmm. you know, intrinsic. It's quoting, in fact, St. John Paul II, who mentions in a speech, an Angelus speech he gave, that the infinite love of God spilled for us is what makes our dignity infinite. So you can see how there's an equivocation there. Clearly, St. John Paul II, nobody would say, and the Holy Father in this document would not say, that we are somehow equal to God.
Right.
But I think when we speak of, it speaks of the infinite dignity, it is simply saying the dignity, there's a dignity in us that is ontological, metaphysical, and is immeasurable. So it's not quantifiable. In that sense, it's infinite because it's not quantifiable.
Right. And is there also in this, it talks about the being made in the image and likeness of God. So there is that additional dignity that does connect us.
That's right. So, you know, it's interesting. The first paragraph says that this principle is fully recognized even by reason. I'm not so sure anymore that it is.
Yes.
You know, St. Thomas, there's a lot of things that people should be able to recognize by reason, but that because of the culture, because of sin, that they can't, and they actually do need faith. I think this is one of them, because the church's teaching is that we are, have infinite dignity or intrinsic, inalienable dignity because we are made in the image and likeness of God. And we see what happens in the culture when God is taken out of the picture and how dignity gets perverted at that point. Because on what do you base it then? A social contract? Do you base it on abilities and powers and status? What the church teaches and what this document reaffirms over and over again is that there is in the person a dignity that is caused by God and that is inalienable simply by being a member of the human species.
And not given or granted by the state.
Amen to that.
Yeah. All right, Father, let's pick this up. There's a lot more to talk about. I'm having fun. I don't know if anyone else is, but I'm certainly always blessed to be able to talk with Father Thomas Petrie. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is Cresta in the Afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Matthew Bunsen filling in for Al today, who is tied up with the Ave Maria Radio Pledge Drive. Please support Catholic Radio, support your local EWTN Catholic Radio station wherever you may be. Continuing my conversation with Father Thomas Petrie, Dominican, president of the Dominican House of Studies here in Washington, D.C., where I'm also based, and we are discussing Dignitas Infinita, the decree from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith on human dignity and the many threats that exist today. And Father, the document itself makes note of the fact that here we are at the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It says at the very start of that that we have the recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family, which is a foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. So it's an interesting hook to make. But we have to make a few qualifications of that, don't we?
Well, it's an interesting thing that the United Nations said that in 1948, and I don't think anyone would disagree with it in 1948. I'm not sure everyone would necessarily agree with it today. But see, this was a problem with the Enlightenment, because Western civilization, especially Western civilization, is founded on the Judeo-Christian faith, which has a God. Judaism was the first religion in which there was no such thing as a religious nobility. You know, leaders were not divine. Everyone was equal before the law and equal before God. And it's only because of the Judeo-Christian faith that Western society comes to any notion of morality and human and the man being made in the image and likeness of God and therefore having any dignity. But by the time you get to the Enlightenment and the advance of science as we now know it and the advance of ethics and politics as we now know it, you actually have people like Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and in some ways Karl Marx questioning how can we find a way to be ethical, because they wanted to keep the morality but
right.
without God.
Yes.
And it's not possible in the long run. It really isn't.
Right. it still comes down, doesn't it, to the human person made in the image and likeness of God.
Yeah.
Right. Whether we accept it, acknowledge it, or are willing to recognize that it is there. So looking at the question of dignity then from a Catholic standpoint, we have a whole section in Dignitas Infinita on what they call a fundamental clarification. Yes, it says we have agreement on the importance and normative scope of human dignity and on the unique transcendent value of every human being. However, they note that there are different interpretations surrounding it. And it says, this brings us to recognize the possibility of a fourfold distinction of the concept of dignity.
I loved this part of the document because when I teach moral theology, when I taught at college students and when I teach seminarians this, the Dominican student brothers this, it makes some of the distinctions that Thomas would make that the church has always made. So there is that ontological dignity that we were talking about earlier, this intrinsic, infinite, inalienable dignity because we are made in the image and likeness of God. But then there's traditionally we think about what it calls a moral dignity. How do we use our freedom? And are we using our freedom in accord with our human nature or are we perverting it? And when we sin, we lose something of our dignity. And I think everyone who's been well catechized understands that while I have this, what I would say, this foundational intrinsic dignity, there's more dignity to be had.
Right. It's not like there's a certain amount you can't have anymore.
That's right. I can't grow in it. Moral dignity, and the more I grow in holiness and virtue and do good things, the more dignified I actually become. And by contrast, if I sin and become vicious and vice-filled, I become less dignified. So that fundamental distinction, I think, is something that hasn't been fully articulated as well in previous sort of documents, even from Benedict XVI's time and John Paul II's time. So I'm really happy that's kind of noted here that you can actually lose dignity. Even if not, you can't lose that basic dignity of being made in the image and likeness of God.
So there are two others though, right?
Well, these two others are interesting. This is where I think you see some openings for like this broader understanding of dignity that you were speaking about earlier, Matthew. So the document mentions such a thing as a social dignity, which is referring to the quality of how someone's living conditions are. So think of people who are living in extreme poverty and how that is in some ways, living in an undignified manner. So it's a social dignity. It's not a judgment, the document says, on the person.
Yes.
It's more of a judgment on the culture and on what the qualities that create those situations. And then it speaks of an existential dignity. And this is where I think we come up against some of the issues that come up later, like euthanasia and assisted suicide. When you are ill or if you are a person with disabilities and you are made to feel that you do not have a full dignity or a full life, this is what the document refers to as an existential dignity. I'm not sure that's the best word for it, but
yeah, because it seems almost repetitious in terms of ontology.
That's right. So yeah. I don't know. I would say I don't know what word I want, but I can see where they're getting at here. I think these two, social dignity, I have a better sense of what that means, and I certainly know what they're getting at with this word existential dignity. But it is an interesting word to use.
Yeah, you could. I mean, something like almost domestic dignity.
Right.
I understand.
I mean, it's almost like a perceived dignity, but I don't know that I want to use perceived because that implies it's a subjective thing, right?
Right. And the document itself tries to help out a little bit, where it talks about in situations of presence of serious illnesses, violent family environments, pathological addictions, and other hardships may drive people to experience their life conditions as quote undignified. Vis-a-vis their perception of that ontological dignity that can never be obscured. So it does try to make that.
So it is speaking a little bit more about perception. You know, because of the situation you're living in, you can have, you know, we think about people, we use the term sometimes, right, existential crisis. You know, you've got terminal cancer, you've been given, 2 months to live. You can go into like an existential crisis and feel like, and not really see anymore the dignity of your life and the dignity of your humanity and the dignity of being made in the image and likeness of God. So that it is a sort of existential dignity. Yeah, I see that. I see what it's groping at here.
But it also then goes to that it is worth mentioning that the classical definition of a person as an individual substance of a rational nature clarifies a foundation of human dignity. As an individual substance, the person possesses ontological dignity. Having received existence from God, humans are subject to Subjects who subsist.
This is all St. Thomas.
Right.
This is all Thomistic language, Aristotelian Thomistic language.
Hurrah for scholasticism.
It just warms my heart. You know? No, so all this, what this really simply means is that every human person from conception to natural death, regardless of disability, regardless of even real genetic disabilities, think of something like autocephaly or something like that. Because you are a member of the human species and you subsist or you exist anonymously as an individual and you are part of the human species, which is to say you have a rational human nature, you have all the qualities of being in the human species, and because every member of the human species is made in the image and likeness of God, there is no conditions upon which you have to earn your intrinsic ontological dignity, and there's no way it can be taken away from you. You are always a human being. You are always part of the human species.
Which raises one of the questions that percolates throughout this whole thing, and that is this idea of the imposition of a kind of subjective view of the world and the self.
So this is an interesting question, and this, I think, is the challenge of our present culture, right? The document speaks about this in terms of freedom and also in how the culture tends to see dignity simply in the freedom to express oneself, right? So this is around paragraph 30 or so in the document, that individual expression of who I am, and that you must, in fact, not only respect but acknowledge and in some ways applaud my self-expression, whatever that may be. Otherwise, you are harming my dignity. You know, this is, I think, everyone can recognize that's where especially Western culture is
right
at this moment. So there really is no common ground of even speaking about human nature anymore because, you know, you can affirm something about your humanity that I don't accept and don't agree with, but I'm supposed to do so.
Or affirm something that is also completely contradictory to biological reality.
Absolutely.
Or sort of existential reality.
Absolutely.
But the word also that comes throughout this document is freedom.
Freedom, you know, and this is where you can get into Evangelium Vitae. I know it's not cited here, Veritatis Splendor,
right.
You know.
Which has been noted that it is not cited, but Evangelium Vitae is.
Yet Veritatis Splendor, John Paul's understanding, this is St. Thomas's understanding, that freedom is not simply freedom of indifference is what we call freedom. We tend to think as modern Americans that freedom is simply the power to do this or to do that, the power to choose. That's not the classic Christian understanding. It's not the classic Catholic understanding. Freedom is, in fact, the will following the intellect to what is truly fulfilling of human nature. What makes us different than the animals is not only that we pursue our good and the things that we find to be good, and we can also be sometimes mistaken, but that we can actually know the distinction or the relationship between what we're doing and the goals we're pursuing. So one thing I always like to tell people is that freedom in the human person is not neutral. We tend to think freedom as a neutral power I can use any way I want. Freedom is, in fact, made to unite us to God. We are inclined to be united to God. And when we don't use our freedom properly or correctly, that's why it's a sin. And that's why it's so perverse. And that's what the document says. The more you get away from God, the more freedom becomes obscured. It's St. Paul, I do not do the very good that I want to do. I do the very evil that I hate.
Yes. But you've also noted the presence of personalism in this document.
Yeah, so this is an interesting, of course, personalism has a number of branching tentacles, you know, beginning with John Paul's theology and his pontificate. But here, it's not only the personalism of wanting to be rooted in how the person makes use of the human nature and freedom, but once again, being critical of an understanding of dignity that is only focused on person and what it means to be person, because then you get into all these problems that we see in our culture in which you can begin to define who is a person, what is a person, and if you do not do these certain things, you are not a person, which is, you know, being able to communicate, being able to do this or that, which is why the unborn are not accorded rights, which why those who are severely dealing with severe disabilities are thought of as lesser. Those who cannot contribute and are dependent are thought of as lesser and not having dignity. But focusing it on the human nature and the fact that the person operates and must be faithful to the human nature and to the God who gives the human nature is what is the ground of real dignity and authentic freedom.
Now, you also use the name Carl Truman.
Yeah, Carl Truman is really great. I recommend his works to everybody. He's right now, he's a professor of historical theology in Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He wrote two wonderful books, and I'll just mention them. They're both available on Kindle. One was The Triumph of the Modern Self, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. Now, that's a very long scholarly book. A lot of people are probably not going to read that, and someone told him that, thanks be to God. Our good friend Ryan Anderson told him that. But a better book is Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity in the Sexual Revolution.
Well, I think Strange New World is a very apt term for our present moment in history. Father Thomas Petri, let's continue this conversation after the break. We are discussing Dignitas Infinita here on Cresta in the Afternoon. Please, don't go anywhere. A lot more to talk about. Back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Matthew Bunsen filling in for Al today. Remember to tune in to Open Line with Father Mitch Pacwa Wednesdays at 3 Eastern on EWTN Radio. Anytime you can listen to Father Mitch is a good day indeed. I'm filling in for Al today because he is tied up this week with the Ave Maria Radio Pledge Drive. So please support your local EWTN Catholic radio station wherever you may be and wherever you're able to listen. And continuing my conversation in this hour with Father Thomas Petri, the president of the Dominican House of Studies here in Washington, D.C. He's a great friend. And I also want to do a shout-out to your kind expertise in the two episodes on St. Thomas Aquinas for my series, a documentary series on the Doctors of the Church for EWTN.
Can't wait to see that when it comes out. It's going to be great.
Yeah. It was fun to do that with you. And to tie us to Dignitas Infinita, which is our conversation for this hour, as you've been noting several times, there's a lot of Thomas in this.
There is a lot of Thomas in this, and I think generally rightly understood. You know, there are debates about how to interpret certain elements of St. Thomas's thought, and there was certainly a large debate on how St. Thomas's thought was used in Amoris Laetitia several years ago.
Yes.
But it seems in
or
this...
Or misused, according to some, yes.
Yes. But in this one, it seems I have no complaints. I mean, it's really a great... Dominicans always... And when you're talking about Dominicans and Jesuits and St. Thomas, it is a fraught issue, just
yes.
So you know. Yeah.
Yes. There are a number of historical occasions where they come to mind. But in this one, we're talking about the different forms of existence we had and dignity, the ontological and the moral. But then it talks about and devotes a huge chunk of this, not just to the enumeration of human dignity and all of its ramifications, but what it describes as some grave violations of human dignity. And it makes the note that it says, while not claiming to be exhaustive, the following paragraphs draw attention to some grave violations of human dignity that are particularly relevant. And the list is a pretty long one. It's the drama of poverty, the travail of migrants, war, human trafficking, sexual abuse, violence against women, abortion, euthanasia, and assisted suicide. Talks about the marginalization of people with disabilities, gender theory, sex change, digital violence, and somewhere also tucked in here is surrogacy. One of the things that has emerged in the discussion, the often heated discussions, of course, on social media, in particular on X, is, again, these would-be theologians. Is this, because of the way that this is enumerated, the way it's organized, is this some sort of a stealth effort to create a seamless garment argument, which and talk about why that is such a trigger word, so to speak.
So the seamless garment was basically popularized by Cardinal Bernardine in the 80s, right? So with this idea that the ethic of life, that there's no weight, that it should be seamless, which is to say we should be equally committed to all life issues, not just abortion or euthanasia, but to things like poverty, things like avoiding war, things like immigration. And in a certain sense, you can see how that is true, right? But
yes.
But objectively, it is the case that abortion is more grave than, say, capital punishment, because in one, you're talking about the intrinsic evil of killing innocent babies, innocent people. In the other, you're talking about the tradition and the church is teaching that states have a right to defend themselves against aggressors. That's also true for war. Now, that has been a sticking point between various camps in the church theologically and between certain moral theologians. I think it is probably true in this document. It does not seem to give weight to one of these over and against the other. So it could certainly be used to advance a seamless garment argument. But I think once you read these documents, as we always should, in light of the documents that have come before,
yes,
it'd be much more difficult.
Right. And it does state, too, I'll say that again, it's while not claiming to be exhaustive, the following paragraphs draw attention to some grave violations.
Right.
So there's no effort here, it seems to me, to downplay the intrinsic evil of abortion, euthanasia, and assisted suicide. And you used the term earlier that's important to note with so many of these categories outside of that, prudential judgments in
yes.
how we approach this.
I think that's right. And so, and I think it's, and this is unfortunate part of the Pope Francis' pontificate, because there's been such an emphasis on footnotes, is everything. Every time a document comes out, you have people who want him to be more progressive, people who want him to be more traditional, are attempting always to read some sort of meta-narrative in the footnotes and in how things are organized. And I don't think that's helpful. I think that just leads to agita.
Right.
So I'd rather just read it at face value and interpret it according to what has come before, because he is a pope, he's a successor of St. Peter, and he is a son of the church, and he is a successor to his predecessors.
And parenthetically, it's always interesting, and this has been true for a decade with him. People seem to be unwilling to just to take him at his word.
Yeah.
Now, his spoken word.
That's true, and because he has said several things, you know. Like, for instance, I know he has said oftentimes publicly, I want people to disagree, you know. And sometimes, like even in Amoris Laetitia, right at the very beginning, he said, I am not attempting to propose any real definite solutions here,
right.
You know. But that was sort of ignored.
Right, and we almost started this conversation almost an hour ago now, talking about the weight of this document. And we had in Amoris, we had an apostolic exhortation, post-synodal, mm-hmm. which has its weight. We have this document, which has its weight. But there doesn't seem to be anything in here that would say, well, this is ex cathedra.
Right.
Which, of course, it's clearly not. And yet there are some who would have made the argument that fiducia has probably more weight than it should.
Yeah, that might be true. It certainly seems that's what Cardinal Fernandez wanted after it, like they made sure that to indicate that he approved it in audience. And then this later that day, I don't know if you remember this, on the Vatican website, they actually posted under the document the ticket to prove that they had an
yes.
audience with the Holy Father that day, which they've never done before. And it was clearly
right.
because they were getting pushback.
Well, and we had the interesting exchange yesterday at the press conference at the Sala Stampa in Rome, in which he spent most of the time that he was supposed to be talking about Dignitas Infinita talking about fiducia.
That's right. And quoting canon law and submission of intellect and will, which was interesting. Clearly, it's still a briar for him, you know. So, probably wasn't the best first document to come out as prefect of the dicastery.
That's fair.
But this document
too
is good.
What would have the reaction been to fiducia had this come out first?
That is an interesting question. I wonder. I think it would have been very different, right? If this had come out first, there would have been probably, I think, there would have been more credibility established. I hate to use that word. You know,
yeah.
I mean, His Eminence is obviously a cardinal, you know, and a priest and a good man. But I think people would have been – this is more a traditional, normal sort of document that you would expect to come from the dicastery from the doctrine of the faith. And as we mentioned earlier in the hour, was in fact subject to multiple rounds of consultations of theologians in a way that Fiducia Supplicans was not.
It's interesting that in this enumeration of these grave violations of human dignity, it starts with something that is, I know, of great personal concern to Pope Francis, and that is what it refers to, and that this is the interesting turn of phrase, is the drama of poverty. Not simply poverty, but the drama of it.
This is, I think back to Laudato Si, which was another document of Pope Francis that was was a source of consternation for many people on both sides of the spectrum.
Right. Followed, of course, by Laudate Deum. It was sort of like, you apparently did not read Laudato Si.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you read Laudato Si, and I know it's categorized in some ways rightly as a document on the environment, I think it was more a document on poverty and the human situation and the human person. And his, and here you see this kind of referred to again in this section on the drama of poverty, that there are real inequalities in country world. In some ways, that's to be expected in a fallen world of original sin, that there is going to be inequalities. However, what we see and what he pointed out in Laudato Si and what's being pointed out here is that places, richer countries or countries that are more wealthy, are in fact stripping resources of poorer countries and making living conditions for the people living in those countries much worse. And so therefore lowering their social dignity, we might say, even if they have an intrinsic dignity.
Well, and there's that phrase that Francis likes to use, which is ideological colonization.
Yes.
And he has, I think, used that phrase repeatedly, especially in his visits to places like Africa.
Well, and not only that phrase, but I think about his phrase on the throwaway culture, which he uses not only in regard to pollution and how we're stripping resources in the world of some countries. And, you know, and I'm not a big believer or scientist on climate change or all of that. I don't follow all of that. I mean, I can understand both sides of that argument. But I do think it is true that there are countries that are suffering from resource deprivation because of what other countries are doing. And that, so the throwaway culture, which he uses not only to refer to that reality, but also to abortion and how we can throw people away in our lives, you know, those who seem to us to have less dignity.
Well, and connected to that ideological colonization are two of the major items that are discussed here. One is, and they use the phrase again, gender theory. Mm-hmm. Francis likes to use gender ideology. And the other is sex change. And I want to read very briefly from paragraph 59, where it talks about the fact, therefore, all attempts to obscure reference to the ineliminable sexual difference between man and woman are to be rejected.
That's pretty strong language.
Very strong language, yeah.
Very strong language. You know, earlier we were talking about this personalism about people being able to self-determine, and it comes back up here in this gender theory because that's what we're seeing, right? That you have to affirm, someone says, I'm a man, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. And so that gender theory, not only as regards to this idea, and the document says it leads to this idea of making oneself God, that I can determine what I am and you have to respect it. But then also this big thing that you just mentioned, Matthew, sexual difference, and that there is such a thing as sexual difference. And we're seeing this play out in our culture right now. I mean, I think especially, you know, talking about biological men engaging in women's sports. And clearly there is a sexual difference, a biological difference.
Yeah, for which we might now be put in prison if we point that out in a few places.
I think that's right.
Like Scotland, perhaps.
Yep.
But then in the paragraph 60 on sex change, it talks about the dignity of the body cannot be considered inferior to that of the person.
Oh, I am so thrilled with this because, well, this is my doctoral research. You know, my book, St. John Paul II's, the Thomistic Foundations of John Paul II's Theology of the Body. We tend to, in our culture, I think, devalue the body, and we have for a couple centuries now a sort of Gnosticism, seeing the spirit as more important than the body. But the Catholic position has always been that the human person is not just a soul and not just a body, but is in fact a composite of body and soul. And both realities are part of who we are and define us as who we are. And so this idea that the body is somehow can be transformed into an instrument, and we see that in any number of ways, not only in the trans ideologies, but also in how people want to modify their bodies or how they think that their body is simply a tool to be used, when in fact what happens to the body profoundly affects the soul and the mind and vice versa. St. Thomas has this great line where he thinks that the body, it's not that the soul is within the body, it's that the body is within the soul, and everything that happens in the soul is somehow manifest in the body. That's how close the relationship is.
Well, and it quotes the Catechism. And that we have to recognize, as it puts, quote, the human body shares in the dignity of the image of God. Such a truth deserves to be remembered, especially when it comes to sex change, for humans are inseparably composed of both body and soul. And it strikes me that compounding this is the sex changes or the so-called euphemism of gender-affirming care for minors. This seems to me to be one of the great moral crises of our time.
Absolutely, and it's starting to be known. It's hard to talk about because when we have people who are coming out of the trans movement, you know, they're shut down often by the advocates.
Well, Father, this has been a real treat and an honor to spend this hour with you talking about Dignitas Infinita.
Thanks for having me, Matthew.
When we come back, I have a few closing reflections on this document and the human person. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.